In this episode of From Bench to Fireside, Pisces Chief Scientific Officer Dr. John Connolly taps into the wisdom of Dr. Lanier, Distinguished Professor Emeritus at the University of California, San Francisco, and former Center Director for the Pisces Center at UCSF. Dr. Lewis Lanier is a cancer researcher known for his discoveries in the immune system's natural killer cell space. For more than three decades, Dr. Lanier has researched this type of white blood cell and its innate and adaptive responses to pathogens and cancer. During the chat, Dr. Lanier shares insights and discusses key innovations in NK cell biology that could improve cell therapy. His work training generations of prominent scientists helped progress the field of cancer immunotherapy as a whole. Get ready to go from bench to fireside for a candid conversation with cancer research veteran, Dr. Lewis Lanier.
I'm John Connolly, and I'm here with Dr. Lewis Lanier.
One of the things that really stood out for me when I joined PISI a few years ago was the center that you built there at UCSF really distinguished itself from all the other centers in the focus on young investigators. And this is something that just is clearly came across in the way you built it, this kind of echo, the support that you've had, and the way you use PISI funds to really lift up those young investigators. So is this something that you've seen throughout your life? I know in your career, is this something that mentors in the past have helped support you early on in your career? Is this something that you've then take forward?
Yeah, I think it's our responsibility from the beginning in training people. I was in biotech for 20 years, but I had quite a few postdocs there. But they're your science kids. You need to take care of them, make sure that they succeed. You can feel happy and proud when they succeed. So I've always tried to keep in touch. I think of like my 48 or 50 prior fellows. I know where all of them are except for two, and a lot of them came to the party we had for my retirement celebration in June.
Yeah, that's amazing. So just for everyone's sake, Lewis did just retire very recently, both as a center director and his role at UCSF. And I was just completely floored by the get together of just incredible scientists that came together that trained Dundee Lewis. And I'm sure there are just many more that they're training, because they're not just trained in the way of the scientific techniques and being taught to be a scientist, but also how to be a mentor too. So it really starts, as you said, an incredible family of children and grandchildren, if you will.
Great grandchildren now.
And great grandchildren. That's spectacular. What you mentioned a little bit about biotech, and I think this is something I think that is really important. Technology does drive a huge amount of scientific discovery. So early on, I think you'd done early work, if I remember correctly, at Becton Dickinson, right? In some of your early part of your career. And really at the dawn of flow cytometry and early technology. So how was it, how did that then lead, that access to technology lead to many of the discoveries and the work that you've done, and how did that shape your career?
I think that you always have to say, what is the biological question that I'm trying to answer? Technology for technology's sake, I'm not really that interested in, but when I can use a new technology to fundamentally break through and answer a scientific question, I think that's what you have to do. As a grad student, I stared down counting cells under a microscope for fluorescent cells. And that was at the dawn of when flow cytometry was invented at Los Alamos and then at Stanford. And I realized at that point that if I wanted to continue understanding the immune system and analyzing the cells, flow cytometry was going to be huge in being able to dissect and take apart and understand the immune system. So I took a gamble. The fellow that I did my postdoc with was a fellow named Noel Warner. He had been a postdoc himself with Len Herzenberg at Stanford. He was Australian. I think he might have been one of the only grad students of Sir McFarlane Burnett, the Nobel Prize winner. And I think Noel got his PhD when he's like 20. Really brilliant guy. But when he was in New Mexico, affiliated with the Los Alamos labs where flow cytometry was originally invented. So I went as a postdoc with him, and that was when Len Herzenberg and Becton Dickinson decided to start a new center in Mountain View, California, to take advantage of the developing flow cytometry. But more importantly, when I was a student, monoclonal antibody hybridomas had also just been invented by Cesar Milstein. So I realized I had made polyclonal serum, but I realized monoclonals were a lot better. So again, I learned the technology to then answer the biological questions. And I've continued to do that since. I think you always have to say, what tool do I need to answer this question? Right. I know many of my friends who went into flow cytometry are still running like flow cytometry core type activities. Sure. I've always just used the technology to answer the fundamental question.
That convergence of hybridoma technology out of Cesar Milstein's group and the amazing work at Los Alamos and Stanford to develop flow cytometry, and this really led to the identification of not just cell types, but receptor systems like the NK cell receptor system that you dove into early on and really defined. When it came to immunology in general, what really led you into taking a step back, perhaps? What led you into immunology? Where did that interest come from? And how did you get into that, if you don't mind me asking?
I was a microbiology undergraduate. And okay. I still remember I was taking a virology course. Yeah. And this virologist, they explained to us about this virus called LCMV. It's, and it is transmitted from mother to baby mouse, and it's not a lytic virus. So if it's transmitted vertically to the babies, they are infected, but they never get pathology. But if you give the same virus to an adult, they get sick. And I said, how does this work? And this is, maybe it's the way your immune system learns self to not attack your own tissues. Now the virus looks like self. So I said, wow, how does that work? And when I was a senior in college at Virginia Tech as a microbiology major, they had their very first new course in immunology. It was a graduate course taught by a guy named Klaus Elgert. So I asked if I could take his graduate course because I thought, there were so many unanswered questions about how the immune system worked. That's always driven me, the curiosity of figuring out things that are unknown.
That's fantastic. It's such a cool question, and it's one that still deserves exploration. It's amazing. And so with the application, though, of that fundamental knowledge now, and the big mission and for PICE has always been making all cancers curable disease, and it's one that you've really just done great work in. So how is it that you then went into cancer from there? You know, microbiology, infectious disease, what led you to treating cancer?
When I was a PhD student with Jeff Houghton at UNC Chapel Hill, we were doing transplantation biology. And one strain of mouse that we were studying was getting spontaneous B-cell lymphomas in that strain. So this is now called the CH series of tumors, CH1, CH2, et cetera, that are widely used. It was one of the first models of B-cell lymphomas in mice. Wow. So at that time, Jeff Houghton, my mentor, said, we need something that is tumor specific to treat these. And the V regions of antibodies are unique. Yes, so we made what was called anti-idiotype antibodies that would recognize only the immunoglobulin on the surface of those B-cell tumors. So I cured a bunch of mice with anti-idiotype antibodies against the surface IG of that B-cell tumor. So that's what kind of spurred me into the question, how does it work? How is this antibody causing complete cures of these animals? So this is a precursor of CD20 antibodies, right, for lymphomas.
That's great. That's
fantastic. But I said, how does this work? That's how I stumbled into Fc receptors and ADCC. I made Fab2s and they didn't work. But then I said, it looks like this is being mediated by some cells killing the antibody-coated cells.
Yeah.
That got me into NK cells, which are one of the best mediators of ADCC.
Yeah, and for sure.
What receptor does that? I clone CD16.
Yeah, that's it. With regard to the NK cells and even Fc-mediated killing, where do you've seen the development of cell therapy coming up in certainly through the PICE network, but even obviously with incredible work from Carl and from Michelle Sadelain and many others that have really, really pushed this field forward in terms of cancer care. Where do you see NK cells kind of fitting in that cell therapy model or for cancer care?
No one's ever been killed by putting NK cells into them, unlike T cells. Yeah. So if we can actually get the same efficacy with NK cells as we do with CAR T cells without the tox, I think that's where the benefit's going to be. I'm on the board of a couple of biotechs which are trying to achieve that. There are some challenges. I think we need to tweak a few things, but now ability to use CRISPR and modify the NK cells. Right. One of the issues is longevity. That's always been a criticism of NK cells don't live very long. But we and others in mice and humans have shown there is a population of human and mouse NK cells that can last And the latest data in humans says they can last at least 3 years. That's not your garden variety in queso, which only lasts a month or two. So trying to figure out what that special program is that allows for that persistence, if you can do that, and then put the CARs in those cells and get them to hang around, and more importantly, proliferate when they see the antigen, I think that that will do it without the tox, because we know CAR T cells have killed people.
Oh, for sure. They definitely have. And even from the context of, in a lot of the areas where people look is an allogeneic cell therapy with NK cells, people have, you know, HLA-C matched and mismatched and to get a treatment. And graft-versus-host disease is a real thing when it comes to using allogeneic T cells and something you don't have to address there. With regard to that long-term persistence, I think there's just amazing work in the tissue-resident NK cell space that's coming out. I think maybe the single-cell technology has allowed us to really dive deep into some of these subsets. And do you think that there's something to be said about those kind of liver-resident or tissue-resident subsets of NK cells that are antigen experienced and perhaps even a little more persistent than what we're seeing in circulation? Are these kind of the subsets you're trying to mimic, or are there other characteristics?
NK cells have never caused autoimmune disease.
Right.
The way when NK cells really do their job and what they were evolved for was dealing with infections. You have to figure out a way of mimicking the microenvironment of virally infected tissue.
Yeah.
In order to provide the cytokines, like NK cells can't make their own growth factors.
Yeah.
So if I put an NK cell with a tumor target, it kills it nicely. In viral infection, the NK cell not only sees the virally infected cells and kills it, but the neighboring cells will make goodies like IL-15 and IL-12. And those are the gas that allow them to proliferate. We and others have data saying that an NK cell, when its antigen receptor is stimulated, can proliferate thousands of times, but you have to give it some cytokine that made by someone else.
I think conventional CAR T, sorry to interrupt you, conventional CAR T therapy that can induce local myeloid activation, lots of interferon gamma production, IL-12. It seems like the NK cells could be that effector arm to a lot of conventional CAR T therapy, where in solid tumors, where you'd be going after, say, your favorite HER2 target or something like that, and you're getting different mechanisms of killing through perhaps Fc-mediated killing on a secondary target. And so just because, as you said, that local microenvironment is going to be wildly, if you've done right, wildly Th1 polarized. And I'm wondering how much work has been done in that space to actually look at, there just haven't been that many successes in the solid tumor CAR T yet, but as it comes out, what is the role of secondary or bystander NK cell activation really driving most of that killing, or a lot of that killing?
I think the other thing is, as happens with the T cells, is if you go into an environment with a lot of IDO, a lot of TGF-beta, it shuts the program down. So I think that's the other stumbling block you have. I know several in the NK space, several of the companies are actually putting in TGF-beta dominant negative receptors or knocking out the receptor, things like that. And it works in a plastic dish. It works great. We'll see if that's going to translate when it gets into a patient. With NK, the other thing which people have done so far with the CAR is just constitutively express IL-15. It'll make them divide a few times. Okay. But I think being constantly soaked in IL-15, we know, basically just burns them out. My idea, which I had one of my Parker-funded fellows working on when I decided to close the lab, was could you, in the CAR, give a growth signal as well as a killing signal?
Yeah.
So you engineer it so that they would only, when they saw the target, get like an IL-15-like signal or an IL-12-like signal. It wouldn't just be soaking them in that all the time. That's what good advice I'm giving, and I'm hoping that my intuition turns out true.
It's like a signal 3 there, where you're really, in one receptor system, you've got the entire, you back and forth immune response. It's brilliant. Hopefully we'll see that in the clinic. When it comes to the other area that I think it's really fascinating that your lab has really pioneered a lot of is the regulation of NK cell, both activating and inhibitory receptors. on the NK cells themselves, but also on T cells, where they're being upregulated later in these responses. Could you talk a little bit about that biology and how that then fits into overall T cell immune responses?
I know of not a single receptor expressed by NK cell that isn't also acquired when you chronically hit a T cell. So they turn on all the exacts. I know of nothing that's NK specific. That's all amazing. Of those genes that I've cloned, in fact, are expressed by T cells. And they do the same thing functionally, because the guts of a CD8 T cell and the innards of an NK cell, the signaling pathways are the same.
Yeah.
So when you put, if I take any of the NK receptors and transfect them into a T cell, they do what they're expected to do. So when people talk about all these checkpoint things, essentially, with the exception of PD-1 and CTLA-4, which NK cells really don't express, all the other ones that are being tested, in fact, also are expressed by NK cells. So I've told everybody, keep your eye on what's going on with the NK cells in those patients to see if you're activating them also.
Yeah, particularly you see this in things that work as synergy. So there aren't that many checkpoints like LAG-3, for instance, which works with PD-1. It'd be fascinating to dive deep into LAG-3 biology and whether or not that's actually acting on bystander or NK cells, whereas the PD-1 might be acting there. I think it's just this dynamic of the response from a sort of class one restricted killing in the context of a CD8 T cell, transitioning towards something that may be non-class one restricted, or selecting for things that maybe lose class one under that kind of selective pressure. Do you think that's the question comes, why are you upregulating all these receptors, NK cell receptors? Do you think this is something that really just reflects the dynamics of the local immune response, or is there another reason why they're putting these receptors up on the surface?
I think T cells put on these inhibitory NK receptors to keep the T cell alive.
Got it.
If you hit the T cell receptor too hard, we know from Art Weiss's work and everybody else that you induce apoptosis.
Yeah.
So you need to just hit the sweet spot of being able to activate, but not too strongly. And I think the reason the accumulation of these T cells with these inhibitory NK receptors is it's kept those cells alive to work another day.
So maybe there's even a selective process is going on here. You're seeing the ones that made it through the process, and the other ones that weren't able to do that are being culled from the population. That's great. That's really cool. I think it's incredibly, these receptors need a lot more exploration. I'm excited that you and the companies that you're advising and other people are really pushing these cells forward. It's something that we've got huge hope for. So with regards to the center, we talked a lot about the Pisces Center. When you built that center, what were you thinking about when you designed that? We've got just for everyone's sake, we've got a lot of different centers in the center director's design. Some of them are very focused on clinical trials. Others are focused on technology platforms and high-end CRISPR screening and identification. But I've always, maybe you could talk a little bit about the design of the UCSF Center. It's really been an incredible boon to the network overall. But what were you thinking when you put that together, when you designed it?
What I was thinking was you can spend a lot of money very quickly if you spend it on clinical trials.
For sure.
And most of them won't work. We know that. So I thought with the resources that Sean gave us to do this, I thought the best thing that I could do is with the emergence of immunology being taken seriously in cancer therapy, getting together and kickstarting the careers of the best young, bright people in that field would have a much more sustainable influence. Absolutely. Than funding one trial. So Absolutely. With that, I decided that I use a lot of these people that we have recruited are being recruited by a lot of other very good places. But this gave me a little extra incentive to put into their startup package. And also, not just the startup package, but when they're establishing their labs here, to be able to give them quickly pilot funding to do risky experiments. So I used that to, I got Matt Spitzer, Justin Equim, Cole Roball, Alex Marson. I got all of them started by putting IC resources and providing infrastructure, getting the latest technologies and subsidizing that so that people in their lab could use that. So I think that really has a much longer lasting impact than just paying for one more screen. Because the future is having the best possible people and also get people who are synergistic and will work together. The other basic the philosophy I used was, I said, what I want to do is not just give people who have a lot of money some more money, but I said, you have to get our kind of little internal grants that we've given out. You're going to get extra bonus points to be funded if you will work with somebody who you haven't worked with before that'll bring in a new idea. So many of the grants, $200,000 range or $400,000, I said that you'll get them if you'll do something new that is just not more of the same from your lab. And you'll collaborate with someone you haven't collaborated with before to bring them into the network. So that was my philosophy from day one.
Absolutely borne enormous fruit. Just the investigators you mentioned, this is exactly their attitude as well. They're huge collaborators, diving deep into their own science, but also really linking up with clinical trials, with some of the big investigators that are running studies at Penn and at MD Anderson. It's just been an incredible group of collaborators that you built there at UCSF. And so with as you built that out, this focus on young investigators has really borne fruit, not just in the scientific advances, but also even getting into patients, the biotechs that have come out of the people you just talked about. So we're moving the technology into companies, putting professional teams on that and trying to get that out into cancer care has really changed a lot. How do you see that biotech sector as it interacts with academia? What's the role of biotech, do you think, Lewis? You've been involved in a number, you're advising, but you've also mentored many real entrepreneurs and throughout their careers.
Drugs are made by biotechs and pharma, not universities. So you have to have that partnership if you actually want to take something that you've discovered in your academic lab and see if it works in people. You cannot do that at the university. Yes. You've got to have an interaction with pharma and biotech to achieve that. So I think having those relationships and partnerships and bringing them into that network is how we're going to cure patients.
And you have to have that line of sight. I know that your center, at the Picey Center and actually Picey in general, it's all about really making all cancer curable disease and having that line of sight from the blue sky science where your creativity is right in front of you and you're answering really fundamental questions all the way to making change in care. And these are different people with different expertise to do these different things. And I think what we're trying to do here and what you've really shown can be done is by creating those connections and breaking down those barriers, we can actually really make a difference in patient care. So this is something that we're really excited about and pushing forward. So one area that we're really advancing to is the Scholars and Fellows Program. And this is, again, a focus on young investigators. But how do you see that some of the scholarships that went to UCSF and that are going through the network, how do you see that changing the careers of some of the young scientists?
Ken Hugh, who was one of the scholars, is now in MD Anderson in Jim Allison's new institute. I originally hired both Matt and Justin as Parker Fellows, and then progressed to faculty members. So I think it shows that track works of being able to pick out the bright young students and fellows and giving them the opportunity and the resources and the connections really does pay off. And you could probably make a tree, a genealogy tree of the postdocs and fellows that we have supported through PICE who've gone on either in academics or in biotech to have an influence. I think I've also demonstrated to the younger people that you can be successful in both biotech as well as academics, as long as you keep doing good science.
Right.
That's what the most important thing is.
Yeah, keep your head down. One of the highlights that you've done as well as center director is really around building a symposium series, which we love the Northern California Symposium Series. We're linking up a lot of the local institutes. One of the other areas is really your leadership at the retreats. The PICE retreats are so important for maintaining the network and really opening up these collaborations. How do you see the retreats and how did you use those to guide the collaborations that you've had at your center?
Most of us who are senior in the PICE network, we're really busy and we're always traveling somewhere. We don't have a chance to sit down and me and Bob Schreiber and Phil Greenberg and Carl to have a beer and actually talk about new ideas. So I think that really has kickstarted. I've got a couple of now papers with Carl that would have never happened if we hadn't been interacting at the Parker retreats in exchanging ideas. He'd see what things I'm doing that complement what the skills are in his lab. In fact, we just got notification today that we're going to have another paper that's going to get published together. And we even got Carl working on NK cells now.
That's outstanding. Fantastic, Lewis. That's amazing. And yeah, Lewis, I just wanted to thank you so much for the time. If there's something, this has been really incredible talking to you. I don't get enough chances outside the retreat to sit down and talk to you. So it's really been amazing. So I wanted to just thank you so much for taking the time. You're so generous with it. And talking to us about your time at Pisces Network. And we look forward to seeing you at the next retreat.
Thanks for listening to From Bench to Fireside. And special thanks to this season's Pisces Network contributors from Dana-Farber, UCSF, Stanford Medicine, Mount Sinai, UCLA, Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center, and Weill Cornell Medicine. To donate to support Pisces' mission, please visit parkerici.org/donate. You can find From Bench to Fireside on Spotify. To be notified of new episodes, like or subscribe to our channel. For the latest at the Parker Institute for Cancer Immunotherapy, follow us on X and LinkedIn at ParkerICI or visit www.parkerici.org to learn how we aim to accelerate the development of breakthrough immune therapies to turn all cancers into curable diseases. From Bench to Fireside is produced by the Parker Institute for Cancer Immunotherapy. All content and opinions expressed in this podcast belong solely to the Parker Institute. From Bench to Fireside is a trademark of the Parker Institute for Cancer Immunotherapy. We'll see you next time as Parker Network experts in immunotherapy take you from behind the lab bench to the frontiers of cancer research.